This is Audible.
Audible Studios presents Child of a Mad God, The Coven, Book 1. Written by R.A. Salvatore, performed by Tim Gerard Reynolds.
The Lakeman's Lament. On the Firoch, Daemon sit, curses muttered, fire spit. Hunting people their delight, spilling blood and making fright. Better fear than praise of men, the daemon strike with spear, not pen. For the bounty they will take, food and furs and bones to break. Daemon footfalls leave no mark, coming silent, cannot hark. Come in fury and in shade, come with magic in the blade. Glittering spear alit with fire. Lightning speaks with daemon ire. Throwing stones without a sling, fly away without a wing. Oftentimes a lakeman strays into Firoch daemon's ways. Oftentimes the daemon's smile bleeds the kill for all the while. Uskar daemon, why such joy to break the smile of a boy? Uskar daemon, why delight in spilling blood and making fright? Prologue. The moon called it forth, the summons of blood, long and sleek and low to the ground. The fossa crept across the underground crawl space, some areas with no more than a foot of clearance. The demon creature felt every jag and bump in the stones, for it had little fur left on its 6-foot-long body, with only occasional tufts along its reddish, angry skin of welts and boils. Its tail extended back 3 feet, perfectly straight, and was flattened and hardened, with its edges scraped keen like a scythe. It walked on 4 padded paws, moving cat-like, killing claws retracted, and perfectly silent, save the occasional scrape of that hard tail on stone. The demon creature came through the narrow and rolling crawl space into a taller corridor, and there it paused and inhaled, smelling the scent of life on the mountain, and hearing the song of the mountain's magic. A sensation that drove the beast mad with hatred. So many months it was trapped in its lair of murder, in the darkness, that maddening song echoing about the stones. But it could not go out and kill the singers. It could not release its rage upon an animal, or a man, or a she, for under the light of the sun, or the stars, or the normal moon, the song was too strong, and would drive the fossa back into the cave. But not tonight. Tonight the moon was red, the blood moon, and so the fossa could come forth, and taste blood, and devour magic, and silence the singers. Faster it loped, through the corridor and into the small cave, then to the mouth, and there the fossa paused and looked up to the night sky, to the huge full moon, hanging red. Promising food. What would it kill this night? What creature's bones would add to the litter of the deep den beyond the long crawl? What singer's throat would crush beneath the press of its maw? It came out into the open air, under the red moon. Hunger called it to the hunt. Perhaps a deer, perhaps a bear, or a warthog, or a great rock, or a giant mountain ram, or one of the ugly she-humanoids. None of them gave the demon fossa pause. None could stand against its savagery. None, though, were savory, and gave the demon the pleasure it truly desired. The sensation froze the creature just outside its bone-littered cave, At first, the vibration drifted on the night breeze as just a tingling, teasing and tickling. But then those sparks became something more. Something that stung. Something unpleasant. The creature let forth a feral growl that reverberated about the mountain stones. A warning, a protest against the painful intrusion, the maddening resonance of magic. And that was the rub. Not the pain, for the fossa was ever in pain, but the vibration of magic. An incessant burr the creature could not scratch away. How the demon fossa hated magic! The song of it played as an endless voice, a pervasive and incessant ringing, just a single maddening note in its ears, and vibrating throughout the creature's body with a singular message. Murder. But the growling stopped very quickly. The fossa sensed the pulse of magic. A human was out on the mountain this night, under the blood moon. And that human carried magic. And that magic had been called, and so it was singing now. The demon fossa set off, silent as the shadows. The animals of Fearoch Spuir could rest easy this blood moon night. Aye, for the fossa's favorite meal was served. Ravines did not slow it, nor high slabs of stone. For the creature traversed ledges with sure-footed ease, and could leap straight up a score of feet, 2 score, and with claws that could catch hold in the stones as readily as a cat might climb a tree. Down the mountainside it went, down and around to the west, where the plateau rolled out wide before it, and the red moon reflected in the waters of the great lake far below. There was no pause to take in the grand vista, though. For the song grew louder and more focused as the fossa neared. So much louder then, and the fossa slowed. Over one rise went the fossa, through a tangle of trees, and into the brush at the edge of a field of chokeberry bushes. There the creature hunched and watched and waited. The man came over an angled stone across the way. He carried a long spear, its tip glowing with magical energies, singing brilliantly. He moved down slowly into the low brush and stepped his way into the middle of the patch. He was hunting, the fossa understood. He was hunting the demon fossa. He was a fool. The man stood amidst the chokeberry bushes and whispered something the creature could not understand. But the sounds gave the fossa pause. It hunched further, and from the concealment of the taller brush scanned all around, ensuring that this one was alone. The human spoke again, as if not alone, but the fossa saw no others. There were no others. The fossa issued a low growl, then silently circled as the man turned toward the sound. The man sniffed. He could smell the demon, and the demon fossa could smell his fear. The man set himself, that horrid magical spear tip forward, toward the place where the fossa had growled, as if expecting a charge. But the fossa wasn't there anymore. There upwind from the human, so that he could still smell its lingering scent. No. The fossa was already across the way, watching the human from behind. The breeze gusted, the chokeberries shivered, and the human shifted left and right, but with his focus still to the spot where the fossa had been. Belly to the ground, the fossa moved, gaining speed, readying a killing leap. But somehow, the human knew, and he spun about, that spear flashing across. The fossa burst from the chokeberries and cut fast to the right, then back across to the left, too swiftly for the man to keep up with his lumbering sweeps. The spear tip chased, but could not catch up. And right by the man rushed the fossa, and out the other way. But as the creature passed, its tail, a sword of bone, slashed across to take the man's legs out from under him, and to take the man's feet from his legs. A short distance away, the fossa skidded to a stop and spun about to see the man struggling to his knees, bringing his spear around defensively. He seemed excited, elated even, ready for battle, and he moved as if to stand. The fool didn't even know. Only when he extended his leg as if to stand did he scream out in pain, and then, and oh, it sounded as the sweetest music of all to the fossa, in fear. Only then the fossa understood. Did the human even realize that he had no feet, that both of his legs had been severed at the ankles? The human looked all about frantically, even reached for a severed foot sitting atop a nearby chokeberry bush. Amused now, the demon fossa watched the human regain some measure of courage, stubbornly using his spear for balance as he forced himself to his knees. Then he took his spear in both hands and shouted a challenge. The fossa calmly stalked a perimeter about him. Time was not on the human's side, not with his lifeblood pouring from his severed ankles. The man spoke again, as if in conversation with some unseen other human. "My daughter will not be shamed," he yelled. The fossa stalked before him and stood staring. "Come on," the human yelled, waving his spear. The fossa sat down and let him bleed. But then he hugged his spear, that crystalline tip glowing with magic, and whispered again, as if to the spear. And the magic intensified suddenly, the song assailing the demon creature, particularly so, for it was a song of warmth and healing. The human closed his eyes and seemed to bask in that healing. The fossa ran to the side. It could smell the lessening of the blood flow. It could hear the song of healing magic. "Where are you?" the human cried, seeming stronger again, invigorated, healed somewhat.
"Coward," he taunted,
or tried to, for the word came out with a giant exhale as the demon fossa slammed into his back, its fangs closing fast onto the back of his neck. The fossa knew that he wanted to turn and strike, but knew, too, that its fangs had cracked through the neck bone, that the human's body would no longer answer commands. Down they went together, the fossa smashing him down face first through the chokeberries. The fossa didn't finish him, not then. It would drag the human to its lair and eat him slowly, while he was alive. But first, that spear, the magical crystal. The fossa released the human's shattered neck and sprang for the spear, its powerful maw clamping on the spear tip, cracking it, shattering it. And the demon knew that it was not alone, that the human had indeed not been alone. For through this magical spear tip, there loomed a spiritual connection to another human, the true singer of the magic. And she was there, in the spirit realm, joined to the man in his hunt. And the fossa heard her song, and felt her trying to strengthen the flow of magic into the doomed man who lay in the chokeberries. But the fossa was more than a physical being, so much more. And the spirit world was its truest domain. Into the darkness it went, and it found her. And it knew her then, Ilara. She tried to flee, to send her spirit flying back to her own corporeal form far away, but the spirit of the fossa saw her and followed her. She could not escape. The fossa couldn't bite her neck or her mortal coil at all, of course, but it didn't have to. It could eat her soul. It could shatter her mind. This kill was less substantial, perhaps, but to the fossa proved far more satisfying. To its surprise, the magic singer spun back and returned to the man, and found him there, and he, her. And the fossa found them both, their spirits huddled, embracing as the demon closed. And it knew him then, too. Fionnlagh. The human spirits drew comfort from each other, but the fossa was amused, knowing such comfort a fleeting thing. The demon creature mocked them as it dragged its victim to the dark hole in the dark cave. It watched them as it consumed the man's corporeal body, watched his spirit flitter away. The woman's spirit flew away, but it could not escape, the fossa knew. It sat in its hole, atop a pile of bones, the torn carcass before it. But part of the demon creature went with the woman, too, back to her tent, where she lay on her back, staring blankly, seeing only darkness. Her magic consumed, her life force diminished, her mind shattered by the horror. The horror.
Part 1. Curious Child.
Do I believe in redemption? I suppose I must. For how can I forgive myself my own sins, if not in the belief that I can and must atone? Are my crimes so monstrous that I can never return the balance of justice? So heinous that, no matter what I do with the rest of my life, I will never lie in peace on my deathbed, confident that, in the end, I left this world a better place than I found it. I can only shrug, for that is not for me to judge, nor is it why I believe in redemption, nor is it, in the end, the measure of redemption. For such redemption is first and foremost an internal truth, a realization toward the proper and just course. You told me of Brother Francis, so long a thrall to the evil father Abbot Marquardt, who was responsible for the death of your own brother, Grady. You spoke of how Francis, in the end, found repentance in tending to the suffering peasants who had been caught by the rosy plague. Francis, this man, your enemy, gave his life in service to them willingly, joyously, because he found the light of goodness, and it swelled his heart. And in the end, in the moment of his death, you stood with him, and felt generosity in your heart, and felt sadness at his passing. And against your own anger, in his last revelations of his part in the death of Grady, you threw aside your pain and anger, and forgave him, and even wanted to save him. How can I know the tale of Giuseppe and Brother Francis, and not believe in redemption? So many times since my defeat and exile have I been told that I was tainted in the womb, that the demon Dactyl, in battling my mother, had found a way to paint my heart with its darkness. I do not doubt that there is some truth to this, for those who have made the claim, from Lady Dathlerond of the Tuol Alfar to my mother herself, who lies forever still beneath this freshly tilled ground, knew well the evils of her great foe. But the demon I harbored from my past, the stain of Bestus Bulzebar that infected my soul when I was a babe in the womb, is no excuse. The dark influences that weighed upon me, whether by Marcalo de Unero or the Dactyl demon itself, do not exempt me from blame, do not diminish the truth that it was I, Adrian, who ultimately made the choices. It was I who exacted suffering upon others for the sake of personal gain and glory. We are not trapped by heritage or by childhood. When we come of age and discover the ability to see the world as it is around us, the choices we make, whatever our demons, are our own. The love my mother held for me was lasting and generous. And so many times those who love us will offer such excuses, blaming friends and peers for taking us down a dangerous and dark path. No, I say. Simply no. I reject your excuses, beloved mother, even as I weep for losing you. Whether or not the demon Dactyl did as you believed, and so cursed me with blackness in my heart, I long ago accepted the responsibility for my actions. That acceptance has not broken me. Far from it. And that darkness, whatever its root, does not remain within the heart of Adrian Wyndon. I have passed my third decade of life now. My heart is clear. My mind uncluttered. My course vivid in my mind. I believe in redemption, but only because I believe that I must redeem myself. Not for any personal gain, not even for some ephemeral concept of honor, except as doing so would honor you and Elbrian, my father, and the work you both undertook and the good you both accomplished. I have forgiven myself and dismissed my shame at my failures, and the dark reflection I cast upon Elbrian and Gilsepony, the heroes of Hans. But only because I know that that darkness is now no more. We cannot change our past, and denying it serves no good end. For changing how we speak about it might deceive others, but not ourselves. Those chapters are written. The words are clear, the ink dry. But the book is not complete so long as we draw breath. This, then, is my vow to you, Gilsepony, my mother. I will write better chapters. Adrian Wyndon, Gilsepony's Graveside Eulogy. 1. The World Beyond the World. The last day of the ninth month, Par Vespers, God's Year, 839. The long arms of the strong and lanky boatman reached far ahead, slowly and silently dipping the paddle through the glassy surface of the giant mountain lake. He had never been formally trained, but still, the clever frontiersman moved the paddle so gracefully and smoothly, barely disturbing the water, and thus not disturbing the huge and ferocious monsters that lived in the deep waters of Loch Pyug. Talmadge wore his hair long and beard thick, and both showed a deep mix of red and dark brown. He kept his hair pulled back, sometimes tied and sometimes loose, but always with a thin braid pulled aside and hanging from beside his left ear and over his left shoulder. "Something to chew on," he often said, and often did, using the braid as a constant reminder to pay attention to every detail, to watch for every sign and potential threat. Talmadge had lost track of his own age, but he knew that he had passed his 20th year. That simple fact proved to any who knew this dangerous land that he still had much to learn. For though he had spent the entirety of his adult life, and even much of his mid-teen years on his own, out here in the western wilds, even beyond the wilder lands, and far, far from the borders of the civilized kingdom known as Hans the Bear, Talmadge was still green compared to the other trappers and traders, still of the age where it was expected that he would meet a terrific and horrific ending. The gatherings of the frontiersmen were full of such stories.
"Low branches," complained his companion, a wily and grizzled old woodcat named Sekonk, but known more commonly as Badger, because of his fondness of brawling and his penchant for leaving the other guy broken and bleeding in the dirt. Short, barrel-chested, and spindly-armed, it was often whispered and teased that Badger had a bit of the powdery dwarf blood running through him. Badger took those taunts as a compliment, though, for the bloody-capped powers were legendary for their toughness.
"Then duck," Talmadge replied. "Need I really tell you that? I paid yourself well for the passage," the indignant Badger answered.
"If you'd not, I wouldn't have taken you."
"Bah, young idiot, but your mouth'll get you killed soon enough."
Talmadge glanced over his shoulder to note Badger staring out at the wide lake, then aimed the canoe in closer and leaned way back as they glided under a very low strand of hanging moss.
The distracted man behind him got a mouthful and spat a mouthful back out.
Bah! Too close, Longlegs!
Think duck! Talmadge repeated, and he didn't keep a chuckle out of his voice.
You're too damned close to shore.
I'm not close enough, Talmadge retorted. You want us out there on the open water, in the morning fog?
We know the direction,
Badger argued.
Getting lost isn't my concern, Talmadge assured the man.
Badger snorted.
That again.
Oh, there be monsters.
Bah! No fish is eating badger, but badger's eating fish.
Might that we should have to cut your own canoe?
That you could run farther out, Talmadge said slyly.
I've been on lakes more days than yourselves been alive.
Not this lake,
Talmadge replied without hesitation, and in a more reverential and somber tone.
Not a lake as deep and as cold and as filled with dark shadows. Don't doubt that one of Bjug's hungry beasts would find us where we floating deeper.
Badger eats the fish.
Who said anything about fish?
Talmadge asked, turning about so the old grump could see the gravity in his expression. Indeed, that honest expression seemed to steal the bluster from Badger.
We are staying near to shore, so keep low and keep alert, and try not to let a branch catch you and flip you off the back,
Talmadge went on.
I'm not turning around for you, and your furs would catch me a finer price at Fossach Cran than you'll be getting at Carsailach.
Strange words, eh?
Badger remarked.
Carsailach.
Short willows, then, if it makes you feel more at home, Talmadge replied sourly.
This gruff older man was not going to do well among the tribes of Loch Bjug, he knew. Here, the names of places were more tied to the land, more descriptive and informative.
Simple and pragmatic, like the people, with habits and routines designed to accommodate the ways of the lake, the mountains, the valleys, and the creatures that inhabited them.
There was a beauty in that simplicity, Talmadge had come to appreciate. A kind of common-sense harmony and simplicity to their existence. Unlike in Hans the Bear, out here in the wilds, the land itself was more honored, more respected, and more dangerous than the castles of the barons and the kings. And so the tribes existed on the edge of utter ruin, where a winter storm could make 7 tribes into 6, or fewer, or the lake monsters, or a bear, or a mountain cat, or a goblin, which they called the she, and which were quite a bit bigger here than back in the civilized world, could take the most vulnerable child or the most skilled warrior, and so quickly. And, of course, there were the warrior men of the mountain, the Uskar Daemon, always there, above them, looking down. The villagers along the shores of Loch Bjug did not have the luxury of complicating life. Death always hovered nearby, an ill but constant companion. With gentle ease and practiced movements, Talmadge navigated around a tumble of rocks. At one point, the long canoe, hollowed from a giant cactus, glided in water so shallow that Talmadge could scrape the edge of his short paddle on the rocks, glimmering below in the morning sun.
A better price, you're saying? Badger asked slyly. Why are you stopping short, then? Another 10 pieces of silver for yourself to take me all the way to this Cran place.
They would kill you, Talmadge said matter-of-factly.
They don't kill Talmadge, do they?
It took me many visits and introductions from Silek's tribesmen,
Talmadge explained. A stranger does not simply walk into one of the villages unknown and unannounced. Carsailach is the entry point for all of the 7 tribes about the lake, the village most amenable to folk from beyond the mountain plateau. This is where you will make your acquaintances, and if you prove as lovable as Talmadge, you might work your way about the shoreline to the other settlements, in time.
7 tribes? Been told there were 8. What's yourself hiding from old Badger?
Talmadge settled the paddle across his lap, and turned to regard his companion. He put on a grin for Badger, a mocking grin.
Keeping all the good markets for Talmadge, eh? Badger asked.
Talmadge laughed and directed the other man's gaze up to the huge mountain anchoring the southeastern corner of the lake.
Oh, there's an eighth tribe, Talmadge explained. More nomads than villagers, wandering the great mountain's highways. I can point you to them, but you'll go alone, and you'll not come back. No one comes back.
The ominous ring of his warning hung in the air for a bit, until Badger harumphed and spat back,
Bah, but they're all savages, aren't they? And ugly, too.
With a chuckle, Talmadge went back to his rowing, not interested in correcting the stubborn old fur trader. Talmadge thought that he was quite the clever young man those years ago, when he somehow managed to escape the Rosy Plague and discovered that he could survive in the wilder lands, and even west of that remote region, with his wits and intelligence and the few skills his father had taught to him. Now, still a young man, but so very much more worldly than his years, the greatest truths Talmadge had come to know involved his own limitations. Talmadge had survived and often thrived because he accepted that many of the things he believed he already knew, he didn't really know at all. Savages? From someone who had grown up in a kingdom torn by war, with dueling kings and fighting abbots, with fields of dead men piled atop each other. Savages was not the word Talmadge would use to describe the folk of Lochbeag. He couldn't deny Badger's other claim, however, for the people of Lochbeag were indeed quite ugly by the standards of the eastern men. They wrapped the heads of their infants tightly to reshape their skulls, and to truly shocking effect. Some skulls were simply elongated. Some shorter, but with a thicker, almost mushroom-like hump, and some bizarrely formed into a double hump appearance that was indeed quite off-putting. The few folk back in the wilder lands who had come this way wouldn't even call the lakemen human, often explaining their weird appearance as the result of mating with goblins or powery dwarves, or that they were instead some demonic perversion of humankind. But Talmadge knew better. These were indeed humans, quite civilized, and quite sophisticated. And he loved this time of the year, autumn, because in the autumn each year he could come to Lochbeag and be among the tribes. He snickered again as he considered Badger's reactions. For the eighth tribe the man had spoken of were not ugly at all, and did not reshape their skulls with wraps or anything else. To the lakemen, the eighth tribe were daemon, demon gods. And from all that Talmadge had heard and seen, it was a description, a reputation, well earned in spilled blood. Talmadge sincerely hoped he never saw one of those daemon ever again, nor ever again witnessed the aftermath of one of their devastating raids on the more gentle folk of the lakeshore.
"Getting close?" Badger asked some time later,
the western corner of the southern shore of the lake in view, although with many miles yet to go.
"Tonight, or on the morn,"
Talmadge replied. He eased his paddle up again and glanced out to the lake, spotting the distant sails of the small fishing boats far to the west of his position. Possibly from Fossach Cran, he thought, for they were coming out right under the shadow of the great mountain Shiroch Spuer. Talmadge smiled. Fossach Cran was his favorite settlement, and to his surprise, his initial revulsion at the elongated skulls of the villagers there had worn away to the point where he often found, with a proper tease of the hair, the look striking, and quite appealing. He thought back to 5 years before, to when he was more boy than man, innocent to the world and safe in his family bed. He recalled his mother and father, and his six siblings. Of late, he found that he could hardly even remember their unblemished faces anymore. Still, Fossach Cran reminded him of that town on the western edge of Hans the Bear. This one village on the mountain lake felt a little bit like home to Talmadge. Home before the plague had swept through the land. Home before he had watched his parents and siblings bloat and die horribly, covered in red sores. Something he wished he could hardly remember. He asked himself for the thousandth time, "Why me?" He winced with the weight, the guilt of surviving. He dipped his paddle in the water, pushing the canoe ahead, suddenly eager to be rid of Badger and any other reminders of that faraway world and its complications. The sun was sinking low behind them when Talmadge guided the canoe about the hanging moss and drooping branches of short and wide willow trees that leaned over the water thirstily. The young trader knew then that he wouldn't make Karsailach that day, unless he travelled long after sunset, and far too many dangerous creatures lived in or about Lochbeag for him to like that proposition. So he began to scan the bank for a good place to set camp. On one clear stretch of still water, he put up his paddle and began to turn to tell Badger of his decision, but he stopped halfway around, caught by a most curious sight. A line of orange needles wove its way toward him from the deeper water, and if that was not strange enough, several other such lines were moving all about, and even as he stared at them, many more appeared. It only took Talmadge a few heartbeats to sort it out, recalling the cloderch, the huge orange lizards common about the lake. Huge and aggressive. And now they were coming in from the depths in a swarm. He saw a dozen. Two dozen. Talmadge splashed his paddle into the water left of the canoe and gave a tremendous pull, slightly turning the boat for the shore. "Pull in your paddle on the right and hold it flat there," he cried to Badger.
"Hey, what?"
"Turn! Turn!" Talmadge yelled.
"What in the name of King Danube?
Just turn, you fool," Talmadge retorted, though in truth he had the craft almost facing the shoreline then, so he corrected, "Just row! To the trees! They don't climb!"
"They?
The lizards!" Badger gasped, and Talmadge knew he had finally caught on.
"Are we to outrun 'em?"
the old veteran asked.
"Just row!"
The canoe bounced as Talmadge pulled, and he grimaced and moved his hand near his short sword, thinking that one of the lizards had bumped up against the craft. But no, he realized, it was Badger, up and running the length of the boat, then leaping ahead to the shallows. If it wasn't bad enough that the man had deserted the boat and their supplies, Badger landed in the water, spun about, and shoved back against the moving canoe, nearly capsizing it and knocking Talmadge off balance.
"I can outrun yourself," Badger said, splashing to the shore and laughing wildly.
Talmadge grabbed both edges of the craft, trying to steady it. He had to get up and out, he realized, but even as he started to rise, the boat lurched again, mightily, and rushed in for the shallows, propelled by a powerful lizard. The canoe leaned heavily to the right and turned sideways. It scraped the bottom, hit a stone, and lurched, and Talmadge tumbled out sidelong. He was smart enough to roll with the throw, and savvy enough to grab a rather large stone as he came around, splashing to his knees and hopping to his feet, just as the lizard got its feet onto the sand and stones of the shallows, tossing the canoe about like a child's toy with a simple shake of its large head, and pressing forward at Talmadge. The man pegged it, right on the skull, with the stone. The cloderch hissed and opened wide its maw to display lines of needle-like teeth. Twice as long, tip to tail, as Talmadge was tall, and 400 pounds of claws and scales and murderous jaws, it reared up onto its hind legs, fiery orange in the slanting late afternoon sun rays. Talmadge fell back and drew the short sword from his belt, certain that he was doomed. He glanced at the trees to see Badger already in the lowest branches, and knew that he could not get there, and understood, too, that the man wasn't coming back to help. The Cluderch hissed savagely, and a fan of skin, like small and furious wings, opened wide about its neck and vibrated fiercely, the slapping of skin against scale adding to the sound. And warning, Talmadge. He dived aside as the beast spat, a giant wad of ugly, sticky, dangerous goo. He knew more than one Silech tribesman whose eye had been burned out by the acidic spittle. Splashing and tumbling, Talmadge got to dry ground. But there his heart sank, as more of the giant lizards exited the water left and right, with the hungry beasts snapping maw so near behind him. His mind whirled. These were not pack hunters, but solitary beasts, except in the spring during their mating frenzies. Why were so many about? And how? Talmadge took two steps before he had to swing about and slash across with his short sword to keep the lizard at bay. He nicked one foreleg, but got hit himself by the other, scratching in at his sword arm as it passed. How easily the lizard's claw sliced through his thick leather sleeve and gashed his flesh. He knew that he was lucky that his arm hadn't been sheared off at the elbow. Instead of countering with a backhanded slash, Talmadge flipped the blade into his left hand and tucked his wounded right elbow in close as he retreated. He glanced left and right, seeing huge orange lizards rushing by. With a flick of his head, he sent his thin braid up to his mouth, but he clamped onto it, chewing, trying to sort this all out. For a moment, he feared that he was being flanked. But no. These other beasts were fleeing, scrambling, scrabbling, heads and tails whipping side to side. But not the one before him. Up on two legs still, that one came with murderous intent, claws twitching, tongue flicking. Talmadge jabbed his sword repeatedly, but had to give ground.
"Be a good lad, then," Badger called from up in the nearby willow tree. "My, that yourself will be dead soon enough. So offer some words on how I'm best to speak with them Silech folk, eh? Help me, you fool!" "Oh, I'm not thinking that'd be in my plans," Badger replied with a snort.
The Cluderch lurched forward, maw snapping, then fell forward, nearly overwhelming Talmadge as it went to all fours once more, sending the man rolling away.
"Badger!" he called. "Aye," came the answer. "Right here, watching, and thinking that my own self'll do fine since I'll have twice the haul of furs and skins."
Talmadge growled and fended the charging lizard with a series of slashes and stabs. Back up on its hind legs went the beast, and those collar wings began to chatter, the creature gathering spittle. Talmadge set his legs wide, taking account of his heartbeats by chomping onto his braid, measuring the lizard's delay. Right as the orange lizard spat, the man whirled about to the side, again only narrowly avoiding the putrid goo.
"I knew a lass who could spit like that," Badger called. "Or swallow it, too. Ha! Ha!"
Old Badger actually felt bad for the younger man down there, and it occurred to him that watching this ugly critter eating his guide wouldn't be much fun. So be it. This was the truth of the frontier, the wilds beyond even the wilder lands, beyond in both senses of the word, farther from the civilized kingdoms, and wilder still. Death was a common companion to the folk of these parts, particularly the traders, who lived as hermits for most of the year. Every spring, Badger would go to the gathering known as the Matinee, to discover that men and women he had known over the years were not to be seen again, ever. With a resigned sigh, Badger rested back against the thick trunk of the tree and watched the spectacle play out below him, the lizard trying to eat Talmadge, and the poor, doomed man trying just to stay away, and with no apparent hope of actually beating the thing. But none of the orange ugly things were coming for Badger, after all, or seemed interested in climbing any trees, and that was all that truly mattered. The old frontiersman looked about at the trees, at the short willows, and figured he could find his way to Karsailach easily enough. And now, of course, he'd have far more goods to barter. Even if he had to give all of Talmadge's bounty to the ugly-headed tribe, at least he'd be the lead contact thereafter, and any of the other traders hoping to deal with the lake tribes would have to look to him for expensive guidance. Of course, he had to stay alive.
"My own self will be taking your haunt as my own, I expect," he called down.
He winced as Talmadge dived aside, whacking the lizard with his sword, to no apparent effect. Talmadge almost got away, but the creature bit him on the boot and held fast as he sprawled, and Badger grimaced again and looked to the lake, not wanting to watch the ugly lizard feast. And he looked, too, to the cactus canoe, nodding with relief to see that it remained secure on the sand and rocks in the shallows. Some of the goods had fallen out when the lizard had tossed the boat aside, but they were still right there, up against the craft. He thought that perhaps he should slip out to the boat and float away while the lizard ate. His pondering fell aside, however, as another commotion stirred just off the shore. At first, Badger thought it the crest of the wave. But no, these were fish. Small fish in tight schools, breaking the surface with a series of leaps in a silvery display, and they were throwing themselves right from the lake onto the beach. Badger crinkled his face, not understanding, and stroked his long and scraggly grey beard, casting his gaze out farther onto the lake. And his eyes widened, and his jaw drooped open. A huge shadow passed beneath the surface, not far out. The water rippled, and Badger noted a series of sinewy, snake-like humps gliding through the clear lake. He couldn't make out the exact shape of the thing, except that it was enormous and dark, black like death. He never even saw the monster's head, just that giant serpentine body. But that was enough for him to understand that the thing could swallow him whole. Badger understood, then, why the creatures of this small bay were rushing from the water, even formidable creatures like dozens of these huge cloderch lizards, fleeing for their lives. The shadow passed, gliding away under the deep waters of Loch Beag, and it took Badger a long time to remember to breathe. Suddenly, he wasn't so sure that he wanted to claim dead Talmadge's items. He looked down to see the man fighting bravely and futilely. Talmadge limped as he moved about, his foot torn and bleeding. He had his sword back in his right hand, but he grimaced every time he waved it to block or to drive the stalking lizard back.
"Hurry up and be done with it,"
the grizzled old fighter in the tree whispered.
"I'll spit on your rot,"
he heard the battling Talmadge grumble, and Badger could only shrug and reply, "As you wish," under his breath. The standing lizard swayed, snake-like, as if trying to mesmerize him. Talmadge wasn't falling for that. He didn't let his short sword dip at all, keeping its fine blade ready to stab against any advance. "Come on, come on," he whispered under his breath. He glanced to the side, to the tree with Badger, and growled, for the man clearly wasn't coming down to his aid. And there was no way he was getting up a tree, for the cloderch was devastatingly quick. He still couldn't understand why the other lizards had run past, and were, he hoped, still running, for they were nowhere Talmadge could see. A sparkle down at the lake caught his attention briefly, and he knew it to be a wave of silver fish leaping from the water, as they would to avoid a larger predator fish. But he heard the splashing by the bank, and realized that many had thrown themselves there and now flopped helplessly in the shallow water. Before he could make sense of the suicidal flight, though, the lizard before him reared higher, and out came the wing-like neck flaps, hissing, gathering another blast of spittle. Talmadge didn't angle himself to dive aside, and he didn't roll away. He chewed his braid, watching the lizard's yellow eyes. Eyes that would roll to white right before the creature spat.
Talmadge counted again, silently, ready to spring. Even as the lizard's eyes rolled back, Talmadge leaped ahead. He ignored the pain in his arm and stabbed with all his strength, with all his weight behind the blow, right into the middle of the Cloderc's chest, right between its wavering forelegs. He didn't even know if the thing had a heart, or if his stab had a chance of felling the monstrous lizard. But he struck with all his strength, a last, desperate try. Good fortune was with him, for he knew that had the beast not snapped forward at the same instant to launch its spittle, he never would have been able to pierce its hide as wounded as he was. The sputum flew over Talmadge's ducking head. Once the tip of the short sword got through the outer armor, Talmadge drove it home, plunging the fine blade in deeply, pressing it, pushing it, right to the hilt, as he crashed into the standing lizard, driving it over. Talmadge pitched ahead, the lizard falling over backward, not straight back, for the long and powerful tail countervailed, but off to the right, the two coming down heavily, the lizard's forelegs snapping in tight, claws cutting into the man's clothes and flesh. Talmadge threw his left arm under the thrashing beast's jaw, fighting to keep that terrible maw up too high to bite his face off. And they thrashed and they rolled, and the heavy thing crushed down upon him, and Talmadge screamed out for Badger, certain that he was about to die, trying to cover, unable to defend. It took him a long while to realize that the Cloderc was dead as it lay atop him, and took him longer still to roll the thing aside and climb out from under it. He came up to his knees, only half-hearing Badger's calls of, "Huzzah!" as the man, at last, slid down from the tree. Talmadge was too busy inventorying his many scratches and punctures to take note.
"Ah, but you killed it good," Badger said with a wheezing laugh.
Talmadge struggled to his feet, shaking, trying not to look at the man so that he wouldn't reveal his outrage and his continuing wariness.
"Something big swung by," Badger informed him, walking over. "Big and dark, and chased them uglies from the water."
Talmadge nodded, still trying to sort it out. Was it possible that the fabled beast of Lochbeog had come so near? The mere thought of it had Talmadge rocking and unsteady, and explains the Cloderc exodus and the suicidal flights of the silver fish.
"The blood's leaving your face, ha!" Badger taunted. "You killed the damn lizard to death, and now you're blanching."
"The beast of Lochbeog," Talmadge explained, his voice low, speaking slowly. "The lakemen sail hard to shore, any shore to be away from it. It eats them. It eats their boats. It is a demon monster as sure as is the dactyl. How many lizards ran by us?"
"Scores."
"Seen plenty," Badger admitted.
"And if all of them had turned to fight the monster instead of fleeing, they'd all be dead now. And if their flight hadn't warned us, we'd be in the belly of the monster by now, bitten to pieces."
The older man shifted uncomfortably. "I knew you'd be beating it," Badger said with a snicker, clearly nervous and trying to change the subject.
"You wanted my skins," Talmadge casually replied. "Wasn't about to fight that thing. You could have thrown me a rope."
"Well," Badger said with a shrug, still a few strides away,
"we're all to die, eh?
And profit's profit."
"People do not survive out here alone," Talmadge said, again with a level of complete composure. "There's too many things wanting to eat you, or rob you for their wares, or sacrifice you to some god you've never even heard of. That you would care more for my wares than for my life marks the end of our arrangement and any pretense of friendship."
"Friendship!" Badger replied with that wheezing laugh.
"I paid yourself to take me, nothing more."
"Well, that arrangement, too, is at its end," Talmadge said, and he turned and started for the lake. "Take your wares and find your own way."
When he faced away, Talmadge brought his left arm in front of him and jerked his elbow slightly, dropping a wide cuff of treated, reinforced leather down over his hand. He sheathed his sword on his left hip, too,
pointedly so, that Badger would take note. "I'll spit on your rot," Talmadge whispered again, under his breath. Predictably, Badger closed the gap fast, deftly drawing his longsword, and he stabbed it for Talmadge's back. But the younger man had anticipated just that, and he swung about, left arm leading, the heavy leather covering his hand, catching the side of the blade and slapping the strike aside. And his right hand moved with speed and practice, a single, simple attack routine he had practiced every day since he had first learned the art of fighting. To draw and to stab. One movement, fluid and fast. He saw old Badger's surprised expression, shocked even that he had been so easily goaded by this young man. Badger wore that disbelieving look even as Talmadge stepped into the opening and slid the short sword into his chest, slicing his lung, cutting his heart in half. "We're all to die, eh?" Talmadge said, his lips only an inch from Badger's face. The man could only wheeze in reply, and Talmadge shoved him backward, let him slide off the blade, dead before he hit the ground. The battered Talmadge rolled his head about and flexed his shoulders, stretching away the pain. He glanced around, figuring that the monster, or whatever it had been, was gone by then, and so the other Clodagh would likely soon return. Talmadge wanted no part of that. He looked to the canoe, to the dead lizard, and the dead trader, and noted that Badger did indeed have a length of rope looped at the side of his pack. Talmadge shook his head, disgusted, and muttered, "So be it." He took what he could from the man, and now had a finer sword hanging on his left hip, his short sword on his right. And he put Badger's rope to use as well, tying the man by the ankles and hoisting him up over a low branch. He struggled to get him fully off the ground, low enough for the voracious Clodagh to reach him, but high enough to keep them busy for a while. He thought to do the same with the dead lizard, but he knew he hadn't the time or likely even the strength to hoist the thing. He gave a last look at the dead man, and took a moment to fulfill his vow and spit on the corpse. Talmadge went to the lake, loaded the canoe, and took a few flopping fish as well, as they floundered about on the lakeshore, including one that was as long as his forearm. Then dragged the boat from the shallows and started away, his eyes always to the deeper waters in search of dark things that swam below. He had barely moved from the spot when he heard the first returning lizard, its neck flaps slapping. It probably thought Badger was still alive as he swayed on the lake winds. He heard the spit, then the more gruesome sounds, the chewing and the tearing. Talmadge could only sigh and shrug. 2. Daemon of the Mountain.
"They'll be returning, not to fear," the old crone assured the child. "But what if they don't?" the girl asked, in an even and clear-minded tone that belied her tender age. For she was only then a few months past her third birthday. She looked up at the older woman, unlocked her eyes, and gave a shrug as if to simply accept the possibility. The crone smiled down at her, which elicited a grin in response. It was hard to tell with this little one. She had a slightly crooked jaw, the right side of her mouth a bit lower than the left, and the asymmetry became particularly apparent whenever she smiled. And so every smile seemed a smirk, and made it seem as if the child had a lot more going on behind the grin than simple merriment. The crone nodded, thinking that aspect quite appropriate for young Owlin, if she could even be rightly called young Owlin. This one was wise and perceptive beyond her years, possessed of an old soul and a calculating mind. Her large eyes were beyond brown, were black, like the thick, wavy hair bouncing about her shoulders, and anyone who took the moment to look deeply into those inky orbs
would glimpse their own reflection through a turned prism. Some of the Uskar tribe didn't much like the feeling of those reflecting eyes, for the child's smirking glance sometimes provoked a feeling that the little one was judging them, or perhaps it